This is Pete Fletzer. On this episode of Around the Galaxy, we're talking to author, podcaster, and political commentator, Stephen Kent.
We should not ever pay attention to, like, the fandom menace and that kind of stuff.
Right.
Is that as soon as you even acknowledge that these people are out there and doing their thing, like, you are empowering them in a certain way.
You're listening to Around the Galaxy.
Welcome to episode number 165 of Around the Galaxy, the Star Wars fan talk show. I am your host, Pete Fletzer. Thank you so much for joining us. If this is your first visit with Around the Galaxy, well, welcome aboard. So glad that you could join us. And if this is a return visit, well, welcome back. So glad you came back for another interview, another opportunity to talk Star Wars with some of the most interesting voices in the Star Wars fandom on the ATG Cast podcast stream. Every other Thursday, you either get Around the Galaxy, this show, or you get Podcast of the Wills with my buddy Nick Milkey. Nick takes the opportunity to talk to Star Wars fans and take a deep dive into the canon and look at what it means to them. Always a great show. On Saturdays, on the ATG Cast podcast stream, you get Disturbances in the Force, a little 5-minute Star Wars news digest, bringing you all the information, all the hot stories happening in the Star Wars galaxy over the past week. And on Mondays, you get the audio version of our live Friday night shows, our YouTube show called Streaming Star Wars, where Nick and I sit down, sometimes with a guest, sometimes with just you, our listeners on the show, talking about all things Star Wars, the Star Wars events of the week, the hot topics in Star Wars, sort of a sports radio version of Star Wars conversation. Well, this week, ATG Cast is excited to present a conversation with Mr. Stephen Kent. Now, Stephen was on Around the Galaxy about a year ago, almost exactly a year ago. He is the author of the book, How the Force Can Fix the World. He's a political commentator who you may have seen on Glenn Beck, Fox News, and others. He also hosted a podcast called Beltway Banthas, where he took a look at the politics of our world and applied it to Star Wars, and actually also kind of applied Star Wars to the politics of our world. Really interesting perspective, maybe a little bit different than your perspective, but a great conversation nonetheless. We sort of proved the point that you can disagree on real world politics and find a middle ground on how to look at our favorite saga, Star Wars.
Hey, Pete, it's Clanker, you crazy son of a bantha.
What are you talking about?
You did it. You actually did it.
What are you talking about?
Well, you got Rian Johnson to be a part of Podathon this year.
I didn't get Rian Johnson. Our good friend Alden Diaz from Octo Radio was able to book him as his guest for Podathon 2022 coming up in September.
Dude, I appreciate the modesty. I really do. And Alden is amazing and a good friend of the show. But Rian Johnson is going to be part of Podathon.
Yeah.
Hey, why don't you tell the good people what Podathon is all about?
You've been working on your transitions, haven't you?
Excuse me, what?
Nice work. Podathon 2022 is the third annual all-day marathon live stream event benefiting the Make-A-Wish Foundation. It'll take place on Saturday, September 17th, 2022, beginning at 9 a.m. Eastern and concluding sometime probably after 10 o'clock that day. It's going to be a long day.
I'm going to be tired.
You're not going to have to worry about it. The full-day live stream event is going to feature celebrity guests from around the Star Wars universe, including, as Clanker pointed out, Rian Johnson. There's going to be more announced soon. More than a dozen of the most popular Star Wars fan content creators produce their shows live, and we go before the audience, and we ask them to help us raise money for Make-A-Wish. Last year, we raised $8,200. Our goal this year is $10,000.
Well, Pete, that's very exciting, and again, very altruistic, but I gotta ask, what's in it for me if I was to donate, say, $10, $20, $50, $100?
Well, I'm glad you asked. For every $5 you donate, you're going to get a raffle to win some amazing prizes. We've had things donated by Regal Robot. We've had prizes donated by all the major Star Wars publishers, a couple of collectible people. We're going to be doing an announcement about all the great things that are coming and that will be available to win in the coming weeks. So again, make sure to follow us on social media at The Podathon or go to thepodathon.com for all the details.
And now, Stephen Kent after these messages.
Stephen, thank you so much for joining us and for coming back. And since I probably did botch your intro just a little bit, maybe for the people who don't know you or may not have listened the first time around, give us a little bit of your background.
Yeah, so like you just mentioned, I'm the author of How the Force Can Fix the World, Lessons on Life, Liberty, and Happiness from a Galaxy Far, Far Away. I'm a political writer and commentator. I write for mostly conservative and libertarian magazines and online sites, and I also do a lot of news commentary on, you know, name this conservative channel or that conservative channel in terms of political commentary. So I'm out there. I just finished hosting a show for Al Jazeera called Right Now with Stephen Kent. That was a really interesting experience hosting my first political talk show. I did that for about 10, 11 months. And now I'm in the political polling world in addition to being a roving Star Wars commentator. So I've hosted the Beltway Bantha's Star Wars Politics and More podcast for 5 years now, and we actually just finaled this week, concluding Beltway Bantha's probably the only Star Wars and politics mashup show that there is. I mean, like, that is committed to that intersection every single episode.
Yep.
I don't really know of another one, so maybe I'm wrong.
No, but it's interesting because I think one of the challenges and I face it even with this show is, how do you take a topic like Star Wars, which is so ubiquitous? So many people, you know, I talk a lot lately about the bell curve, where you have the sort of the sweaty nerds at the edges, but the rest of the world knows and loves Star Wars. And how do you create a show that doesn't spend so much time in the weeds of, well, on page 56 of Truce of Bakura, they said blah, blah. You know, that's not what this is about. Yeah. And that was one of the great things about Beltway Banthas, was whether the politics was key to the conversation, but it also allowed for you to take that interesting look from the Star Wars perspective. I think one of the lines that you had, and I hope I don't screw it up too bad, but in the finale episode that you just had, and I was just telling you before we got on, I was sad to see that it's over, but you got your Substack, you got a lot of different ways to keep up with you, so I'm excited about that. But one of the things you said was that, you know, if you were to show a picture, I think of Thomas Jefferson and Princess Leia, was it? To people, they would probably be more likely to be able to identify Princess Leia. And I'm totally screwing up your quote. But it's interesting that the point that you made with that is you're happy that there is some sort of central shared experience. Why could you tell us a little bit more about what you meant by that?
Yeah, no, I've definitely drawn that from sociologist Jonathan Haidt, who has written and spoken a great deal. He had a wonderful piece called The New Babel, like off the Tower of Babel in the Atlantic, just this past month, outlining how successful liberal democracies are defined by three things that they all share in common, which is that they have successful and strong social bonds. So that means, you know, your neighbors, you are part of clubs, your kid is, you know, involved in the local theater, like that kind of stuff. There's social bonds are strong in these societies. The second thing that these liberal institutions or liberal democracies have is shared and strong institutions. So strong courts, strong rule of law, you know, strong this or that. Can also just be, you know, churches, things like that. And then the other thing is shared stories. So shared stories is the thing that I kind of zoom in on here, which is that these kind of societies that endure, they have to have shared stories. And that can be origin story, you know, Constitution. It can be 1776 and fighting off the British to become independent, or it can be 1619. So, you know, if you look at like the left and the right today, jostling over 1776 or 1619, which one's the real birth of America? You're fighting over an origin story. You're fighting over where we come from, which is basically drawing a line in the sand on if we have a shared story, a shared understanding. So there's that. There's also creation. You know, do we come from random particles in a Big Bang, or are we, you know, divinely created by the hand of God? There's also just culture. Bedtime stories, the fables that we tell our children. Is Santa Claus real? The Tooth Fairy, Star Wars. You know, it is absolutely the case that like light side and dark side language, people talking about like, oh, my brother, he's over on the dark side. Oh, you know, he's acting like a Darth today or something like that. Like the language of Star Wars is part of everyday conversation, even among the non-faithful, people who are not Star Wars fans. It has reached that sort of level of common shared mythology. You see this thrown about a lot. That's actually really important for a healthy and functioning democracy to have.
Yeah, and it's a global story as well, which I think is very interesting. You look at, you know, just the fact that Star Wars Celebration, which was enormous, and for me, it was the first Star Wars Celebration I've ever been to this past May. And
congratulations.
It was a big deal. I was very excited to be there. And talk about shared stories. I went with my 75-year-old father and my 9-year-old son, and it was a family experience. It was really... It was unique. But again, it's also it happens it's going to be in the UK next year. And so there's this full globalness to it, if you will.
That reminds me of one of my buddies years ago. His name is Victor. He at the time was living in Russia. He now is here in the United States. And we were talking about Star Wars Episode 3 and, you know, the collapse of democracy and the collapse of the Republic. And he described to me growing up in Russia, and he was like, we thought this was about us. Like, we thought like this, you know, this commentary, the, you know, liberty dies with thunderous applause. Like, you know, remember Vladimir Putin was like elected president, and then he kind of went away, and then he came back with popular mandate, like all that kind of stuff. Like, him growing up in Russia, like, he thought that this story was about him. And, you know, we're all kind of very self-obsessed, like, it's about America, America, America. Right. Well, no, if it's only about America, then it's not relevant to anybody else.
Right.
It's about freedom versus control and autocracy.
And I think that is exactly why Star Wars continues to work 45 years later. It speaks to everybody, and it's got, and I think that's also where you end up sometimes probably with some of the sort of headbutting, if you will, in conversations online specifically, because it happens less in person than it does online. But because there becomes a bit of ownership, I think we talked a little bit about it on last time you were with us on the show, but there's this sort of ownership of Star Wars, and anything that changes my perception of it or the way I see the story becomes a bit of a challenge to me versus, you know, it's, and then it becomes personal. So,
No, it's a big sort of a complicated issue. I mean, people talking about my Star Wars. I mean, we've been dealing with this for decades on end. Something you and I do not have in common is that I'm a child of the prequels.
Right.
You know, I was born in 1989. My first, you know, Star Wars experience was falling in love with episodes 1, 2, and 3, and talking about those movies with my friends. And you immediately like ran into the gatekeeping in that time and dealing with Gen X fans talking about like their Star Wars. And everybody remembers, you know, the talk about how George Lucas quote raped my childhood, which was such an ugly way to describe these movies that these kids at this time, like my generation, were enjoying and you know, getting to love amongst ourselves. There's always been this kind of jockeying over who Star Wars belongs to. And it's definitely generational, I think, more than anything.
Do you think, now that you brought up an interesting perspective, because you're right. And it's funny, it took me many years to become a prequel fan. And I fully admit that. It's, you know, it's an unpopular opinion, but it's, yes, Roger. but it's there. Do you think that we will get to a point where the sequel trilogy will be beloved like frankly, the prequels are beloved now. And again, it's not the full bell curve, but the further you get toward those ends, people have come around to it. Do you think the sequel trilogy will ever get there?
I think that you always have this effect with looking back on the things from your youth. And that is a result of the just natural effects of nostalgia. Like, let's just take this straight to Mad Men and Don Draper's monologue about the carousel. You know, nostalgia is the ache from a wound. You know, it's something that like takes you to a place that you want to go again. And for people like it's their childhood. They want to go to a time in their lives where things were simple, when there weren't bills to pay, when they didn't have, you know, a spouse who you know, doesn't love them anymore, a job that they hate. Like, they want to go back to that place where they feel safe, a place where they feel loved, as Don Draper would put. And for most people, that's going to be on the couch with their brother, sister, their mom, their dad, watching a Star Wars movie, cuddled up under a blanket, you know, eating popcorn. And I think that's what these things are really about. And I really believe that love of Star Wars, and particularly whatever movies you were watching when you were a kid, it's not about the quality of the movies, the script, the music, the pacing, the rhythm, the representation of the movies. It's about, like, who were you watching them with? Yeah. And what was your experience like? And was Star Wars your escape from other things? Or was it just a perfect, wonderful place to be? So I think it's inevitable that you're going to have a generation go back and watch these movies and go, oh, this was a happy place for me. And it's not about the movies. It's about time and place.
Yeah, I think you're 100%. I look a lot at my daughter. She's 12. Her Star Wars experience was The Force Awakens. That was her first exposure. Like, she literally, she was at that perfect sort of princess dress-up age. And before she even saw the film, she went upstairs and created her own Rey costume, which was amazing, like, before she even saw the movie. So it became hers. My son's Star Wars is, oddly enough, Clone Wars, the animated series. So his experience, whereas for me, it took me a long time to get into Clone Wars because it was on, you know, first it was on Cartoon Network, and then it was on Disney, which I didn't have, and it was animated. And again, I am now finally old enough to admit, or I don't know if old enough, but more mature enough to admit that, you know, I was like, it's animated, not my thing. But yet some of the best Star Wars stories out there come in Rebels and Clone Wars. So I think you're right. I think there is a bit of that.
What sort is of my Star Wars? And, like, for me, like I mentioned, like, episodes 1, 2, and 3, of course, but I was really, like, radicalized, like, pushed over the edge of being a mega fan when episode 3 came out. So, like, episode 3 was like, okay, now I'm not just a fan. I'm a super fan. I'm going to buy robes, costumes, lightsabers, make fan films with my friends. And then we got this game, Star Wars Galaxies. It was, you know, it was the answer to World of Warcraft for Star Wars fans. And I just was talking to a bunch of people on Twitter today about Star Wars Galaxies. Because when I think of what my Star Wars is, it's that, actually. I mean, I spent obscene hours in high school playing Star Wars Galaxies, building my estate on Naboo, and building the character of my dreams in a world where nobody could tell me how Star Wars is, or you know, what the rules are, all that kind of stuff. I just loved that game. And I think about playing the remastered, like, homebrewed version of the game, because, like, some developers have kind of revived it. And I think about playing it all the time. And then I go, it won't be the same, Steven.
Right.
You're not 15 anymore. Yep. You have, like, things you have to do with your time. It's not going to be like it was. So don't play. Like, just let yourself love that thing. And never let anyone take it away from you. And this is something that we could kind of go into today.
Sure.
Can someone take away your love of something? I'm very defensive of the idea that they can't.
It's interesting because I think you do have what we saw more, you know, it's interesting because the people have, and I think it's that sort of sentimentalization, if that's a word. If it isn't, it is now, of where you came from. And people have also romanticized and forgotten or choose to forget those comments that people made about the prequels, the things that people hated about the prequels, because for some reason, and maybe it's because of the prominence of the internet and the ability to give voice, loud voice to just about anybody who's willing to get out there and do it, to have a problem with the prequel or the sequels, because the sequel trilogy, add to the fact that it's run by big ugly corporation Disney, right? It's not written by George Lucas, so you're getting all these extra sort of bullets in your gun as to why these are not what you want. But I think, to your point, if I'm getting your point right, the root of it is I'm trying to go back to some place that I loved before, and it's never the same. You go back to your hometown, and I don't care who you are, you go back to your hometown, you'll flash into those memories, but that town is different. You know, it's no longer Jim's Hardware Store, it's Home Depot, and that's that feels uncomfortable. That doesn't feel right to you. And so talk a little bit about what you were saying, but can they take away your Star Wars or your anything?
Well, you know, I mentioned the hallmarks of a successful liberal democracy earlier. So social bonds, strong institutions, and shared stories. I think you'd have to be completely like blind, deaf, dumb to think that like all those three things are in good condition in America today.
Right.
Social bonds are not strong. Our institutions are not strong. And therefore, the bickering over the last plank, the shared stories, which is basically the fight over like, what is the world that we live in? What is our reality? Who are we? That's going to become really ugly, really, really fast. Shared institutions, like the belief in trust in the higher organizations, you know, the banking industry, journalism, politicians, rule of law, courts, all of these things, like if that's not strong, then you're going to start like diverting that attention into other places. And then think about like what it means to people when you love Star Wars. Star Wars is your shared story. And it also is the source of your social bonds. It's the source of a lot of your friendships and connection to other people. I know it is for me. My Comic-Con friends are some of my dearest friends. And when the founder, the maker of Star Wars, sells off to Disney, and you sort of entrusted that person with sort of godlike credibility over, you know, governing Star Wars, because they literally were like God of that universe. They created, they created it with the touch of their finger. And then it's handed over to the committee, to a boardroom, to focus groups at Disney. You know, there's a real like legitimacy crisis there. There is like a sort of a democratic ethic to going like, all right, so this is our shared reality. This is where we get our social bonds from. This is where our shared stories come from. The mythology of redemption for Darth Vader. It used to be in the hands of the maker. Now it's in the hands of a committee. And we didn't agree to this.
Right.
And I think it's actually really easy to see why it has gotten so ugly and so visceral, because we are fighting over like the last shreds of the things that we hold dear. And I'm saying like that is like a perception that these are the last things that we hold dear. So
this is Clanker, and apparently I'm also doing commercials now.
Nice. Just do the read.
Fine. Have you ever been listening to a podcast and thought, I wish I was a part of that conversation? Well, of course you have. Otherwise, have you made it this far into this episode?
Okay, that's nice.
Well, with the ATG Cast podcast stream, you can be part of every show.
That's right. Join the ATG Cast Patreon program today, and for as little as $3 per month, you'll receive a private link to be part of the live video stream when we record Podcast of the Wills and Around the Galaxy.
There are multiple programs to choose from, all with their own unique benefits, including early ad-free access to the shows, free swag, and even invitations to exclusive meet and greets with our celebrity guests. Hey, can I do a meet and greet?
Sure you can.
Ooh, I can't wait to meet the patrons.
No, they're not going to meet you. They're going to meet the guests. Never mind. Remember, every single tier, including the $3 entry level, gets you into the live virtual studio audience when we record. We keep an eye on the live chat, and your question or comment could become a part of our very next episode.
Just visit www.atgcast.com and click Join ATG, or visit patreon.com/ATGcast to join today.
That's www.atgcast.com or patreon.com/ATGcast.
And now, back to the show. Hey, how'd I do?
Pretty good. In 1999, when Phantom Menace came out, the world was in a very different place. We weren't, you know, it was, you know, politically, I think the biggest challenge right now is, and it doesn't matter if it's your family at a Thanksgiving dinner or a stranger on the street that you meet at your local pharmacy or whatever, it's no longer just, we don't disagree on politics. We immediately judge the entire person, and you're forced to take a side, and people judge immediately. If you're wearing a MAGA hat, you're being judged. If you're wearing a Biden shirt, you're being judged. So that's a very different place. So Star Wars, to your point, is another place to have that battle. Whereas in 1999, it was a different, the politics weren't great, but they weren't visceral. You could disagree on whether you agreed with policy or not, and then still, you know, share Thanksgiving
dinner. Well, this is not without cause though. I mean, if you see like the guy with the MAGA hat walking down the street, or today I was in traffic and behind this minivan, obviously driven by a white woman because she had 3 Black Lives Matter stickers on the back of her car, a pro-life sticker, and like a NARAL, so like a, you know, abortion advocacy sticker. And I just, like, I saw this person, I was like, I work in polling and political demographics right now. And let me tell you, the person with the MAGA hat on the street and that person in that van, yeah, I already know a lot about them.
Sure.
I know probably like their median income. I probably know what channels they subscribe to. It's like the magazine subscriptions thing. Yeah. Are they married, twice married? How many kids might they have? All of these things are actually highly predictable now based on how you sort politically. The big sort was the idea that we are sort of geographically sorting ourselves into like-minded political communities and creating sort of a clustering effect. And it is absolutely the case that today, marrying within political affiliation is actually more common than marrying within race or religion. People are marrying with people of like the same educational levels and political views, and then creating children who share their views. Like, this is the world we live in, and it's completely different from 1999. This is why I made Beltway Banthas, because I recognized in Washington, D.C., that at these like political cocktail parties I would go to with like Democratic consultants and Republican consultants and staffers from D&R offices, almost everybody loved to talk a little bit about the Star Wars Senate and the Trade Federation and corruption in the old Republic. Like, you could have like these fun, random, oh yeah, I love episode 3 conversations with just about anybody. Right. And so I was like, okay, let's zero in on this, because if I can understand this Democrat's view of how the Trade Federation is a corrupting force in episode 1, maybe I can have like a more nuanced understanding of how they think about lobbying in Washington, D.C. and the corrupt impact of money in politics. Hmm. It's a vessel.
Do you think there's sort of an impatience as well in the arguments or the discussions? What I mean by that is, because the fact that, as you just said and alluded to, it's, you do know a lot about a person based on what bumper stickers are on their car, for sure. But, you know, the argument that I see on social media, which makes me cringe a little bit, is the line where people say, show me somebody who is a Star Wars fan but doesn't understand it when they're talking about something political. Because there's still that personal insight that you got talking to a D or an R in Washington. They still brought their own sort of insight to that. And so even if you do have an extreme right or left perception, it's not as simple as just a Star Wars story, is it?
Well, no, I feel like George Lucas always understood this completely. And I feel like Star Wars messaging has always been telling us basically to consider the idea that, one, you could become the villain of any story. That's the Anakin Skywalker tale. It is, you know, a story of the virtuous person with good ideas about how the world should be, and basically how that can be a corrupting force and it can turn you into a monster. And also, you know, the Clone Wars idea, like even George Lucas was able to produce and put out an episode of Clone Wars called Heroes on Both Sides. And it's in the opening scroll of episode 3 as well, to like remind us that everybody is the hero of their own story.
Right.
And everybody is fighting against a behemoth, you know, corrupting power, and they're the rebels. So, you know, I got tired, I think, with talking to a lot of like-minded people about how, you know, we're clearly the Rebel Alliance, you know, the Democrats are the empire, da da da. Cause it's just like, oh, okay. You think you're a hero, like right. big deal. Mm-hmm. But it's actually really important to try and grapple with that in some way and have at least, I think, a little humility to look yourself in the mirror sometimes and go, okay, in what ways are we the empire to the other side? In what ways do we sort of have a monopolization of power in this area or that area that scares people who are not like us? And then how can we reckon with that? How can we try to make peace with those people and come to a common understanding? I hope that's not like a rambling answer to your question, but
no, it's
you know, I just always saw in Star Wars a story that was asking us to look in the mirror.
Yeah,
Rey literally looking in the mirror and seeing a million of herself. But you know,
well, so and it brings up an interesting next step for where Star Wars could be going, or what we're going to see. And you know, since the last time we spoke was exactly a year ago, and we've had the Book of Boba Fett, we've had the Kenobi series. We've had Roe versus Wade be overturned. We've had the January 6th hearings. We've had all kinds of amazing Star Wars things and really game-changing political things happening. All at the same time when a series like Andor is about to hit. And I would love your perspective on this concept that I've been thinking a lot about lately. And that is, in 1977... Star Wars was a simpler story. It was literally we knew nothing about the rebels, but we knew they were the good guys. We knew nothing about the Empire, but we knew they were the bad guys. And in 1977, that was okay. In 2022, we as a society, I think as from both a consumer of entertainment and a citizen of the world, good and evil is gray more so than it ever was before. So what's your thoughts on how a series like Andor, which if it follows the Rogue One sort of direction, it's going to show that gray area where bad things have to happen for good things to endure, et cetera.
Yeah, no, I'm excited about this because, you know, obviously when you're engaged in an insurgency against a totalitarian state, and I'm a dogged libertarian, so I love that plot line. That's my jam. When you're engaged in that kind of conflict, ugliness is going to happen. I mean, that doesn't ascribe you a life of getting to walk around in a white robe like Mon Mothma, sort of like aloof and above it all. No, Mon Mothma is going to have people who are out there doing things that she would, you know, like to not have to do. And Andor is one of those people. I think that's just sort of inevitable. But, you know, we were presented in Rogue One with two different directions that you can go when you're in the mud of rebellion and the fight for freedom. It can either claim a piece of you and you can sort of give into that. This is the Saw Gerrera direction. And, you know, Saw Gerrera is a walking, barely breathing example of how political radicalism and the good fight can destroy your humanity. Mm-hmm. Literally. He is a Darth Vader parallel from everything from his breathing apparatus to his mechanical limbs. He's given up parts of himself and his mind and his heart in the fight, and he's not a good person. Mm-hmm. If he ever was, he was always kind of a turd in the bowl, honestly, if you remember in the Clone Wars. Right. He was always a nasty guy.
Yeah.
But then you've got, you know, the Andor direction, which is like, he's done some yucky things. We see him assassinate that guy in Rogue One by shooting him in the back. He doesn't feel good about it. You know, mm-hmm. He doesn't feel good about it. And he always is looking for that thing to be like, I have to know that what I'm doing is worth it. Mm-hmm. Like, if I'm not doing this for a purpose, then why am I doing this? And that's why he follows Jyn Erso to his death. I'm super stoked about this story. And we do need this more than ever. And I think that the reason why is not why a lot of lefty entertainment journalists on Twitter are going to echo, like, my view of it. I think my view of this is that these stories and this rebellion story is going to remind us that, like, insurgency, rebellion, and fighting the state is like it takes a toll on you, and it also is going to demand things from you that are really, really awful. And I think that there's a little bit too much romanticization of that idea.
Yeah. And so now as we look at the inevitable sort of YouTube algorithm jockeying that we will see, and it's obviously it's impossible to preemptively figure out what they're going to say, right?
They're
going to
be so unhappy, Pete. Well, they're going to be so unhappy.
Yeah. So there's two questions to that. Number one is, can you avoid that? And number two, is that something that we as Star Wars fans, that anybody's any entertainment, right? Lord of the Rings is already getting abused. Mm-hmm. I literally had a guy DM me saying that the reason the new Lord of the Rings won't be any good is because, unlike the movies, J.R.R. Tolkien didn't write them. I had to tell this guy that Tolkien didn't write the movies either. He wrote the books. But the point here is, do we have to prepare ourselves no matter what's coming? Because Kenobi was supposed to be the unifying series. And for reasons we may get into in a couple minutes, it was immediately met with the typical pushback. Is this something we just have to live with as fans now? Or how do we, where do we go from here?
Well, I think the realistic answer is yes. First of all, I don't see a lot of, we talk about this, like, you know, Star Wars YouTube and the incredibly angry sort of fanboy culture there, the reactionary right culture. I mean, it's a very sort of seething, conservative environment, right, of grievance politics and pop culture commentary, where it's like, if you want to go watch one of these YouTube shows and channels and be like, all right, you know, like, what's worth watching this week? Nothing is worth watching this week, because they hate everything, because the shows are not about the shows. They're usually about the production, what goes on behind the scenes, the comments that actors make to journalists and to entertainment outlets. It's usually more about that. I'll make an exception for the critical drinker, who at least does some like really good scathing reviews. But look, I think that the reason that we can't get away from this is, one, the focus that people have and the monetization of not being happy. There are just a whole web of channels, podcasts, well, actually YouTube channels, not podcasts, making bank, like really big money off being angry. So you have to ask yourself, if that's the incentive, then why would they be happy with something? Why would they like something? Why would they actually go, you know what, this show was excellent? Because that's not going to be good for their bottom line. So like that, you have to understand that and immediately start tuning those people out. You have to immediately cut that stuff out of your life, because why would you focus one darn bit on that? Your focus determines your reality. And that is not my reality, because I don't listen to it. But the other thing, and I think this is where we can probably debate here a bit, is I think a lot of it is a self-inflicted wound. I think a lot of it is Hollywood, entertainment writers, actors, directors, not being able to keep their trap shut about the social impact that their show or movie is going to have, how they're going to change the world and improve this and improve that, instead of just being like, we made a really great show here. This is the story about Obi-Wan that everybody has been waiting for, his story in the desert while we were gone. It's his best performance yet, Ewan McGregor. No, they want to talk about what this means to the world and representation and inclusion. And then the war starts.
When the extreme points of view, because it also happens on both sides, right? There's extreme points of view everywhere. But when an extreme point of view comes out, I immediately feel like, and it's the problem with politics, right? You immediately take a point. Now, at the end of the day, my thinking on Reva is, I thought she had a very interesting character arc. I would agree with some that say that she was written not as well as she could. And I felt like her ending became a little bit too rushed, right? That said, it was interesting that Lucasfilm led with or at least led her to understand and be prepared for the racist comments that would come out. And then they immediately delivered on what the expectation was. So I don't think it was a checked box. I do think that when you march out diversity as part of your presentation,
part of your marketing strategy.
I don't think it's, and this is where that line is. I don't think it's a bad thing to want to be representative. I think you also need to be prepared though for what that kind of backlash is going to be. I don't understand why, from my own personal perspective, I'm going to sound like a woke SJW here, but I literally don't care that you have female characters leading stories like Lord of the Rings or even Reva. I don't care that she's an African-American woman. I don't care about that. Honestly, I didn't see that until people made a big deal about it. And it was made a big deal by both sides of the argument.
Well, yeah. And so I did like a little research dive just before we hopped on here to kind of review some headlines and news coverage about Reva and the Obi-Wan show. And it's really fascinating to me because I think you correctly hip checked me or whatever it's called, where I was like, Deborah Chow, you know, has kind of been going out and talking about, you know, the triumph of inclusion and diversity in the Obi-Wan show. She actually only gave one interview where she like kind of said this and started talking about like, you know, the triumph of the show as far as, you know, including people of color and expanding inclusion in the galaxy far, far away. And it got like dozens and dozens and dozens of sort of rewrites and replays about, you know, expanding the amount of people that are in the Star Wars galaxy. So Deborah Chow only gives us one interview. But then what you go out and find is just dozens. And this is from the Washington Post to the New York Times to, you know, EW to everywhere, with just articles about like the history of Black folks in Star Wars and Black actors and characters in Star Wars. And what you will find is that nobody is ever happy. Like nobody is ever like, actually diversity has been very much achieved. Even when Rogue One came out, there were articles. I have one right here from Din of Geek and IndieWire, and all about like how Rogue One was like turning this new page of diversity in Star Wars. That is a very, very like awesome, like just color swatch of the galaxy movie. Mm-hmm. And it looks the most real that Star Wars has ever looked because there are people of every shade and type in that movie. It's really remarkable what they did in Rogue One. And I just feel like a lot of the promo around that movie was show, don't tell. Like, I don't remember a lot of conversation coming from the interviewer class or from the actors themselves about that. Whereas when you kind of get Moses Ingram going out there, that is a lot of what you're getting. And then you get pieces commenting on that and talking about it. And it's just like, look, that's not what you want people to be talking about. Mm. If you want people to be talking about whether or not the show was good, it's the wrong metric.
There's so much value to hearing the stories of the little girl who is of Indian descent, who sees a character that looks like her in a Star Trek show.
And that's it. So it's like, it's more people seeing themselves in the characters on screen. It's more people being able to like watch the movie and go, man, like I'm that person. I identify with that person. And that I think is the best, most charitable read for like what representation is. And a lot of times we get really hung up on the proportionality aspect of it, because that's like affirmative action. Like, and that carries this specter of incredible political rancor that is just barely beneath the surface of politics in this country. And it's probably boiled over at this point, if I'm being honest, but like, that is like an entirely different thing. Mm-hmm. And when you get people thinking that like Moses Ingram as a diversity hire, I mean, that's just such a bad starting place for you to be in when you're trying to roll out a movie or roll out a show. She's an incredible actress with like an esteemed portfolio.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't she be in Star Wars? She should absolutely be in Star Wars. I just think that like when you start talking about, man, we did so good in this show and making this show on expanding inclusion in the galaxy, immediately we're focusing on, all right, so did they make Reva to like, you know, put someone like Moses Ingram in the show, or did they always have a character that's a surviving Jedi youngling character, and then they filled that casting with Moses Ingram? Like, was it ever available to everybody? And that's like, that's a really, really like ugly sort of area for you to be in. And so I think for PR and marketing people, you don't want to have that conversation at all. You're a marketer.
Yeah, no, but you're right, because you do. But the where I think the challenge is, I think marketing right now does heavily lean into social issues. And there's no doubt that diversity and inclusion is a hot button. The challenge, to your point though, Deborah Chow said it in one article. It was picked up by various outlets and as many left leaning.
And then I closed the window somewhere.
As many left leaning outlets that picked it up, it became sort of, I mean, there was literally YouTubers and positions taken where they called her a diversity hire. And that's,
yeah. And this is it. So this was the quote. To me, it's long overdue. If you've got talking droids and aliens, but no people of color, it doesn't make sense. It's 2022, you know? So we're just at the beginning of that change. And this was, this was a quote, I believe, from Moses Ingram. Mm-hmm. And so like, first off, right off the bat, that's just not true of Star Wars at all. It's just not true of Star Wars. Never has been. And it sort of like acts like Rogue One, again, didn't happen. Mm-hmm. Acts like Mace Windu didn't happen, that, you know, Lando Calrissian. But the joke has also always been that these were the only black guys in Star Wars ever. Right. Like, you've got this whole galaxy, and Donald Glover did this great SNL skit where he mocked this as well. It's like, yeah, a whole galaxy, and the best you can get is Lando Calrissian. And this piece in the Washington Post that I was reading earlier this afternoon, it's titled, Star Wars Just Made Huge Progress in Its Treatment of Black Characters. And it's about Reva. And basically, it's angry that in the original films, Lando Calrissian was like kind of like a huckster. Like, he was like a disco dancer kind of like black character put into Star Wars. And then Mace Windu, get this, the writer complains that he was killed off like every other good black character in episode 3. Mm-hmm. It's the end of the trilogy. Like, right. Mace Windu survived.
He was in 3 movies. That's
he
right.
survived the trilogy and made it to Order 66 when everybody dies.
Right.
Which is, again, like, this is a reminder. There are some people who are not honest brokers. They are here to try to stir the pot. Right. And they are here to try to be angry and drive those clicks. And like, that's a really good example of that. Reva was a fine character, and Moses Ingram did a fine job. It's just like, when you sort of frame the conversation and victories this way, that is all people are going to talk about. And you're basically daring certain audiences to challenge you on that.
Is there value to that, though? And I know that, it, as you and I both know, value does not necessarily make things right or wrong. But is there... You know, much as I and you talk about how there is money in anger and hate and mm-hmm. and clickbait, does that sort of marketing? Because yeah, I mean, I will say as a marketer, as a Star Wars fan, as somebody who has been, you know, I've been with it for 45 years. As Cassian said, I've been in this fight since I was 5 years old.
Yeah, is that a representative?
Yeah, and for me, it feels like for Deborah Chow to say that feels like it was either A, coached, or B, comes from a place of not fully understanding the saga. Dangerous thing for me to say, mm-hmm. because that is the argument on the geeks and gamers side of the world, is you're hiring people who don't understand Star Wars, which...
That's a ridiculous claim.
Yeah.
And it always comes from a place of assumption and right. a belief that you are engaged in a tribal conflict with enemies who are trying to undermine you.
Right.
I'm reading Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, kind of one of these, you know, classic texts for Stoicism. Mm-hmm. And in it, Aurelius outlines the concept of phantasmia. So phantasma is basically this Greek word to describe our impressions, our understandings of the world based on like what we think is happening. Mm-hmm. So this all ties back to the allegory of the cave, Plato in the cave. So this is the idea that like there are a bunch of people in a cave, they're tied up, and the only thing that they've ever seen in their entire life is the shadows of other things cast on the wall by a fire, okay? That's all they've ever seen, and that's all they think is reality. Mm-hmm. And then when they get free from the cave, they go out and they're frightened by everything else that's out there in the world, and they go, this is all really scary, and they want to go back to the cave where they, at least they understood their reality. And Aurelius outlines in Meditations how your impressions of the world are yours to control. Mm-hmm. There are going to be things that people do. Star Wars hires Deborah Chow to be the director of the Obi-Wan series. And then you get a suspicion and you go, why did they hire Deborah Chow to be the director of this series? Is it for an agenda? And then immediately you're already into the realm of impression. You're right. Forming an opinion.
You're waiting
based
for
off
that
of the
comment.
Shadow that right. you have seen cast on the wall. And like when you actually realize this, and it all ties back to your focus determines your reality in Qui-Gon Jinn, as soon as you start realizing this and being aware of it, your impressions and your biases and your fears completely guide everything that you see. Those content creators, they think that every casting and hiring decision is an act of war because they are in a state of war themselves.
Right. Right. And so that's where so I guess then the question becomes, is a company like Lucasfilm or Amazon with Lord of the Rings or the MCU, whichever, are they starting in a defensive posture? And one of the questions I threw to you over our conversation before we got on today is, mm-hmm. what's the impact of that clickbait side of the world? Is it forcing those sort of pronouncements of we are taking a stand in whichever particular social issue we want to address here, or is it starting on the other side? Or
it's certainly not forcing that. It's not right. forcing those kinds of reactions by content creators, by Hollywood, by Lucasfilm. They are focused on the sort of worst of the worst reaction and then giving it oxygen and giving it air, turning a light on it and saying, see this small thing going on over here that's bad? We condemn it. Well, we know you condemn it. You're Star Wars. You're better than this. You're above this. And there, nobody's, nothing's an insignificant. My view, and this is the view that like we should not ever pay attention to like the fandom menace and that kind of stuff, right. is that as soon as you even acknowledge that these people are out there and doing their thing, like you are empowering them in a certain way. You mentioned like, should they be fighting on these grounds of, you know, sort of having the message be uber important and part of the marketing. And I think it is just obviously a reflection of sort of elite progressive values in Hollywood that are not reflective of the mass public. Mm. We did this poll at my work, Echelon Insights, just the past week. It was sort of a deep dive on the state of the left. And one of the things that got a lot of pickup in national media this past week was a single poll question that we asked Hispanics in our poll. And it was, racism is built into our society, including into its policies and institutions, versus racism comes from individuals who hold racist views. not from society and institutions. Okay, so there are two measures there. People were asked to identify with racism comes from society and in our institutions versus racism comes from people who have bad racist views. So this is the argument between like institutionalized racism versus personal racism. Strong progressives, particularly white progressives, were very, very dogmatic on the issue of America being systemically racist, endorsing that first statement by a 94-6 margin.
Wow.
Like that is a massive, massive margin there. However, Hispanics particularly, and then blacks were right beneath them in this, they were on the other side of this issue, endorsing the second statement that racism comes from individuals, 58-36. 58-36 versus 94-6. Like when you look at that and you sort of step back and think about the kinds of people making Star Wars shows who are Hollywood liberals, like let's just be honest here, they're a very, very niche community who represent that very far progressive wing. They are always talking about race essentialism in a way that everyday people do not identify or agree with. And again, blue checkmark Twitter, they are in that niche community as well. The broad community of Star Wars fans, the broad general electorate, the broad general audience, they do not believe this stuff. They believe that like racism is tied and emanates from bad individual people with bad views, not from the air that we breathe. And this is why Star Wars marketing and its conversations and its stances is the way that it is, because of that progressive versus median democratic view. If that makes any sense, I apologize if that was a tangent.
No, no, it makes a lot of sense because, you know, it kind of goes to the question that I would have for you. Do you think your position, your own personal opinion, was Reva going to be a black actress or a person of color actress? Was that, did you think that that led the search, or was it led by the best actor for the role?
Oh yeah. This is where you get into like assumptions and impressions.
Yeah.
I think that they had a show based around Obi-Wan. And they knew like going in, like representation matters. Like we have to make sure we have, you know, a broad swath of people in the show. Jimmy Smits as Bail Organa, kind of already check, you know, that Hispanic box. And then they're going to have to do something else. And there's only a certain amount of characters that you can create from whole cloth. Leia's right in the show. The Organas are in the show. And they make a character. I mean, I think that's how this went down personally. Now, I don't freaking care. Like I really do not care. What I do kind of care about a little bit is kind of going back to this Washington Post article titled Star Wars Just Made Huge Progress in Its Treatment of Black Characters, is that the argument by race essentialists and people who kind of think this way about representation mattering is that representation has to be like people being able to see themselves in certain kind of characters. So you have to typically have characters assigned a certain amount of virtue. And so for Reva, it was not likely that we were going to get just a cold-blooded killer, because that's not inspirational to a young black girl in the audience who wants to see herself on screen. No, it has to be a youngling who survived the temple massacre, who actually is out on a sort of a justice vendetta against someone who traumatized, harmed her as a child. Like these are then the boxes and the kind of ruts that you're going to get into as a sort of reaction to the only black character we get in the original films is sort of like the huckstery jivery of Lando Calrissian, which is sort of a remnant of the 70s and 80s as far as black casting goes. Like that's a reaction to that. And I think it is a box that you put a person in. The only person that we're going to get for this show is going to be a person with sort of an axe to grind, a justice vendetta. And that's the box she ended up in. And so I think that that's kind of obvious. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, and I think the other, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, as I told you last time, I consider myself an extreme moderate, right? I tend to fall though more on on the liberal side of things, and in some cases much more so. The challenge, though, that I think is a reality here, though, is that let's say Reva was not cast as Moses Ingram. It was, mm-hmm. you know, generic white actress or white male actor. Lucasfilm would have been attacked for not having the diversity and representation that's expected. So from that perspective, mm-hmm. they have sort of fallen into that trap. And then, of course, then the trap bites them on the other side, because now you have people saying she was a diversity hire, which is both sides are sort of blind to, as we started the conversation with. And it's interesting how things actually in the conversation do work out. If you start with the right story, the universal story, yes, in hindsight, the fact that if you go to the very first Star Wars movie, the only African-American voice in the entire film is the voice of Darth Vader, James Earl Jones. However, the story was so universal and was such a fairy tale that lives in our souls, that has been with us for generations. In today's world, if you were to release that, you're going to get attacked from one side or the other. So how do we get back to a point where story matters first? Because I feel like those on the extreme right, the YouTube algorithm jockeys who were pissed off about Reva, really, they didn't give themselves a chance to enjoy the story. And on the other hand, as I said before, personally, I end up like having to take a bit more, you know, transparently, a bit more of an aggressively defensive posture. And it took me, you know, much like it took me a while to go back and love the prequels, it took me a couple, you know, a little bit of time to go and be like, okay, I love the Reva character. I love what she was about. I love what she represented in the story, what she represented somewhere between Obi-Wan and Anakin and blah, blah, blah. But could it have been written better? Yeah. Could she have shown more sort of seepage to the good side? If that's a really weird way to put it,
seepage. But you know, seepage. You are canceled. I'm probably going to be canceled for half of the things I've said in this conversation. But now you're canceled for seepage.
Nobody likes that word. Nobody likes that word. But you know, so story has to come first. But the wrap up question is, can we get back to a place where story comes first? You can still find representation, but not be sort of driven by it or deal with it because you have the right story.
Show don't tell. Just my dream for society is this sort of utopian world where race, sexuality are uninteresting to people.
Right.
Because we're just so diverse and, like, you know, people living their lives in all sorts of different ways with different people that they love, you know, with children of mixed race, which, again, like, we live in a world where that is very, very common now.
Yeah.
And we act like it's not. like, that. This is the world that I want to live in. And as soon as we stop talking about it and stop, like, beating this drum like we are not headed in the right direction, I think you're going to see people just sort of sit back and just enjoy where they're at. I really, really believe that. I think you just have to do the thing. Cast the people who you want to cast for your movie. Tell the story that you want to tell. Surround, you know, Diego Luna with all sorts of interesting people for this Andor series or whatever comes next. And you don't have to say a word about it.
Right.
All you have to do is just let the work present itself. I mean, there's an article topping off the Washington Post magazine today titled, "Someone Gave My Baby a White Doll. How Can We Disappear It?" And it's the story of this Black mom and dad grappling with the fact that their daughter has a white doll that she loves playing with, and they want to get rid of it because, you know, like, this is the problem. And it is the problem that you have sort of this hyper sort of race essentialist focus on one side, the left, and then the right. I don't know how to describe it. You're better at describing, I think, the issues with reactionary racism on the right than I am. But just sort of this recalcitrant hostility on the right to trying to actually like make movies feel more like the world that we live in. Mm-hmm. Like, again, Rogue One, I think, is the perfect example of that.
The question, though, is, I guess, is this having, are they having an impact? Because this is why, the reason I take a stand, the reason I call out the bad actors on the right side, or on the geeks and gamers side, the mm-hmm. you know, that the fandom menace stuff, is because I've seen it. I've seen real world examples where I feel like it's poisoning the insights of the people who float more toward the middle. Like meeting somebody on the street, we both are wearing a Star Wars shirt, and the first question that we get asked is, where do you come down on the sequels? And then immediately this is where we're gonna go. But it's fueled by, you know, the talking points that I hear directly come from the RK Outposts and those sort of things. So
I come from the world of conservative media. Like, you know, my career has kind of been birthed in, you know, doing Fox News and Fox Business. And, you know, this is the paranoia that drives that ecosystem. It is the paranoia of these people, you know, the mainstream media, the Hollywood elites, they hate you. Right. And everything that they do is to try and undermine or erase you. Mm-hmm. This is like the complex that you see now weaving its way from leftovers from Rush Limbaugh's audience mm-hmm. to people who are casually consuming Star Wars movies and then, you know, getting their big dose of conservative media in the afternoon. They generally feel like it is all one hive mind and it is against them. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what to do about that. We have a very, very sick media culture and mass media consumption problem in this country. Mm. There is nothing that we can do collectively to fix it. The only thing that we can do is get our house in order, try to control our own minds and redevelop a sense of ownership over our ability to focus and weed out the people in our lives and in our orbit and in our ears who are adding value and the people who are not. Because as soon as we trick ourselves into believing that the reactionary YouTubers who are never happy about anything are a meaningful constituency, we're now trapped. We've lost. We are now in the mud with them. And I don't want to be. I don't want to be in these people who are sitting around watching movies for, you know, I don't know, Den of Geek or something, and counting, you know, the levels of diversity that it has instead of like trying to track like the emotional arc of the character. I don't want to be like them. And I don't want to be like these people who we've been talking about on YouTube, whose entire life is based around missing the thing that they loved when they were a kid and saying that liberals stole it from them. No one can steal from you what you keep close and guard. I just don't buy that sort of victimhood nonsense, and you get it just as much from the right.
If people take away anything from this last hour, it's that, you know, yeah, the reality is we are not extreme right or extreme left. And I think that that's the problem with politics. It's the problem with entertainment. It's the problem with anything that you want to debate today. We've lost the art of having a conversation about it. It's being able to understand.
Could I add something to that actually before you wrap up? Because, you know, this is like a hard discussion to have. One of the things that's really scary about this conversation is like almost everything that I've said, I've been like, oh, is this going to get me in trouble? It's because like it's really hard to find the right words to talk about this stuff and to, you know, analyze the society that you live in versus the society you want to see. And I hope that like, I appreciate your grace in this conversation and kind of like working through some of these subjects and being patient and, you know, giving me the space to like use the wrong words. Cause I know I've used some of the wrong words.
You didn't use seepage though. So you're probably
describe how I feel about these issues. And I think your audience again, as well, just, you know, be good to each other and be patient and know that like, we're all trying to figure out the right way to say, you know, the way that we see things and the kind of world that we want to live in. Be patient with one another.
Well, Stephen, where can people find you and keep up with you?
Yeah, so I am on Substack. This is the way.substack.com. This is the way.substack.com. And you can pick up my book, How the Force Can Fix the World. Barnes & Noble's, Books A Million, anywhere that you get books.
Awesome. And I cannot say enough great things about that book. And it doesn't matter. Look, if you disagreed with Stephen's perspective on politics here, it doesn't matter, because the way the book gives you an opportunity to explore things is really, really well done. And the illustrations are a lot of fun, too. So.
They are a lot of fun. The book is my love letter to Star Wars. Not the Star Wars that, you know, I wish it were. It's just the Star Wars that it is.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen. And let's definitely talk again soon.
Steve, thank you so much.
Well, that wraps it up for this episode of Around the Galaxy. Thanks to Stephen, and thank you for listening. If you had fun, please like, subscribe, share, rate, and review it. Make sure to follow us on all your social media channels at ATGCast, or visit our website, ATGCast.com, for more information on the show, previous episodes, and links to our merch. You'll also find information about Podathon coming September 17th, 2022. Thank you so much for listening, and may the Force be with you. Roger, roger.